It's Sunday morning, and that wonderfully relaxed feeling of a long, lazy day lingers in the air. If you want to make the moment last, may I suggest the perfect solution? The Martin Sheen Podcast. Join me, your host, Martin Sheen, for beautifully crafted 20-minute programs filled with never-before-heard stories of my life, along with personal reflections and poetry that inspires. The Martin Sheen Podcast is the perfect Sunday refresh, a chance to take a deep breath, relax, and know that the stress of Monday may be just around the corner, but not here, not now. So make this your weekly moment of calm as we explore faith, hope, love, and what it means to be human. And know this, this journey is ever unfolding as I invite you to see what's next with me, Martin Sheen, and thank you.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
I'm Michael Isikoff, and this is Spy Talk. The situation on the Korean Peninsula is more dangerous than it has been at any time since early June 1950. That may sound overly dramatic, but we believe that, like his grandfather in 1950, Kim Jong-un has made a strategic decision to go to war. So wrote two Korea scholars, Robert Carlin and Siegfried Hecker, in a provocative piece for the Stimson Center earlier this year. Their alarming assessment is vigorously debated among the small subset of specialists who focus on the Korean Peninsula, but at a minimum, it's a reminder that international crises and conflicts can pop up when you least expect them. And it raises the vital question about how the two candidates for president would handle a new threat of war with a country that once fought the United States to a bloody stalemate. The always shrewd Zach Dorfman has a new piece in Rolling Stone examining Donald Trump's topsy-turvy dealings with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un and what they might mean for a second Trump administration. We all remember Trump's cozying up to Kim, his so-called love letters that Trump took with him to Mar-a-Lago, and the two summits in Singapore and Hanoi that failed to produce a breakthrough. But before that, Dorfman reminds us, Trump came very close to ordering a nuclear attack on North Korea. Which Trump will it be if he is returned to the Oval Office? The peacenik who embraced Kim, or the MAGA warrior who called him Little Rocket Man and threatened him with, quote, fire and fury like the world has never seen? We'll talk to Dorfman about that and something else he discovered in the course of his reporting. Secret and somewhat fanciful CIA plans to send in paramilitary operatives to topple the North Korean government. And we'll also talk about a story that Dorfman and I wrote together some years ago that has gotten renewed attention in a surprising corner in recent weeks. All that and more on this episode of Spy Talk. Zach Dorfman, welcome to Spy Talk.
Mike, great to be with you.
Well, I should tell you, ever since I started doing this podcast a few months ago, you were one of the guests I most wanted to get on. You have done just amazing work in the intel space in journalism and also in your 10 years at the Carnegie Council and the Aspen Institute. And I should also point out that we had collaborated at Yahoo on a story that still gets some attention, the CIA's efforts to kidnap and perhaps more Julian Assange, which I do want to talk about because it's kind of gotten revived ever since Assange got released. But you had this great scoop and story in Rolling Stone about North Korea. And I want to start out because, you know, you have some amazing reporting in there about the CIA's plans for North Korea, but also just generally, it's not with all the other crises in the world. A lot of people haven't been paying attention to Korea, but you start out with this quote from these two Korea scholars, Robert Carlin and Siegfried Hecker, saying that this is the situation on the Korean Peninsula is more dangerous than it has been at any time since June 1950, when the Korean War broke out. Tell us what we have not been paying attention to in on the Korean Peninsula that causes these scholars to go that far?
Well, first, yeah, I mean, delighted to be here again. Love spy talk, and glad to be able to talk to you about the Rolling Stone article. So, you know, in January of 2024, Robert Carlin and Siegfried Hecker, who were respectively senior officials at the State Department and then at the Department of Energy, and both kind of renowned Korea scholars, you know, wrote that they believed, as you said, that the situation on the peninsula was more dangerous than an attempt since 1950 when the, you know, the war broke out. And essentially, what they argued was that there has been a rhetorical and strategic hardening by Kim, where in the with the failure of normalization under the Trump administration in the rearview mirror, Kim, in their analysis, has decided that there really is no going back, and that, you know, he might attempt to unify the peninsula by force because of this sense within the North Korean regime that there's basically going to be inexorable conflict between the North and the South, and then probably between the North and the South's benefactor, the United States. And, you know, there has been heightening rhetoric over the last year. And, you know, just a few days ago, Kim ordered the destruction of a bunch of roads that were connecting the North and the South. And again, there's just been this kind of ratcheting up of tensions on Kim's side. And what, you know, what Carlin and Hecker write is that there is a tendency to look at this as just a negotiating tactic or just rhetoric. And their argument is that, in fact, they don't believe that that's the case anymore. And they are concerned that the evidence is pointing to an actual outbreak of hostilities on the peninsula, which I think everyone agrees would be, you know, catastrophic.
Yeah. And well, let me just, like, what's driving that from the North Korean perspective? You know, there's no, there haven't been any hostile actions by South Korea that I'm aware of in recent years. What would bring this to a crisis level at this stage?
I think that their argument, and I am not a veteran North Korea watcher. I'm just a kind of dilettantish national security reporter. But their argument is that Kim believed that there might be a real diplomatic breakthrough under the Trump administration. And it's important, and we should talk about this too. We should talk about the evolution in the Trump administration's North Korea policy, because you really can't understand what's happened now without understanding that evolution. You know, you had three occasions where, you know, Kim and Trump met. And this is the first time that a U.S. president met a sitting North Korean leader. There was a summit in Vietnam. There was a summit in Singapore. And then when Trump visited the peninsula, he actually stepped into North Korean territory for the first time. I mean, which is extraordinary, right? I mean, he just stepped literally over the border. But the idea was that
some might have encouraged him to keep going, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, there was this idea. Yeah, well,
walk to Pyongyang. Yeah.
I'm trying to think about the diplomatic incident that would result there. But that there was a real sense on the North Korean side of a breakthrough, right? And that this would change North Korea's international position, right? I mean, North Korea has been under, you know, extraordinarily punishing sanctions, international multilateral sanctions and U.S.-based sanctions. I mean, it's basically, it's a pariah state in many ways. And there was a hope within the regime that the tide would turn and that there would be some kind of rapprochement. And with the failure of that, you know, Carlin and Hecker argue it led to a hardening in the internal calculus within, you know, within North Korea. And so
can I ask, Zach, why did the negotiations that Trump had initiated with Kim, why did they break down and what did they break down over?
Oh, my understanding is they just broke down because the North Koreans wanted, I mean, there was an attempt at complete denuclearization, right? I mean, that has always
been the U.S. policy for decades, right? That's what we want from North Korea. denuclearize, get rid of your nuclear weapons.
Yes. As you said, this goes back decades. And any final, you know, agreement for normalization would have centered on denuclearization. And this, by the way, is why some more hawkish folks believe that this entire diplomatic push was folly, right? Because there's this idea that, you know, Trump believed that he was this master negotiator and he would manage to sit, you know, just by dint of his like capability, he would sit down and he would get Kim to agree that, you know, he did not need nuclear weapons to guarantee his security. But of course, the North was never going to to agree to full denuclearization.
I should point out that you know, there were some who would argue that those who were saying, you know, Trump was giving up denuclearization were wrong themselves, because that cat's already out of the bag. What, they've got 50 or 60 nuclear bombs right now with missiles that can reach South Korea, Japan, even Guam. The idea that North Korea would unilaterally give all them up is probably just not likely at this point.
I mean, especially a regime that is in certain ways so brittle and so paranoid. And it's the mere fact of their, like, the fact that they have nuclear weapons, they are a nuclear weapons state, and they have been for some time, as you mentioned.
They're not going to give it up.
Yes. And the question has been, and there are folks like, you know, the Middlebury Institute who do a lot of really good work on this, like Jeff Lewis. The question has been about delivery mechanisms, right? The, you know, how, what's the quality of their ICBMs? You know, it's not really a question anymore that you said that they could reach targets, certainly in South Korea and in other parts of East Asia. But the question is, do they have the ability to deliver intercontinental ballistic missiles that can reach the West Coast of the United States, the East Coast of the United States? And that has always, I mean, there was a lot of fear about that. There has been a lot of fear over multiple administrations. But if we could go back in time a little bit, in 2017, right, when Trump comes into office, I mean, there's some reporting at the time, this feels like 20 years ago, but it wasn't. And there was some reporting about how the Obama administration told the incoming Trump administration, this is going to be your biggest challenge, because they are.
I think that's what Obama said to Trump.
That's
wasn't
what he
it?
Said to Trump.
When the two of them met.
That's exactly what he said. He said, this is your biggest challenge, because the North has been rushing into it has been evolving rapidly in terms of its capability and delivery systems, which is why, according to reporting that others have done, like David Sanger and William Broden, The New Yorker, about, you know, the attempt to sabotage the development of the ICBM, the North Koreans' ICBM program, right, where there's a so-called left of launch thing, where the U.S. would infiltrate the supply chains of the North Koreans, which is why there were so many faulty launches, right? And so there has been a long-standing covert action campaign.
Are you saying that we were doing to North Korea what the Israelis were doing to Hezbollah, getting into the supply chains?
I mean, yes. Yes, absolutely, 100% yes. We've been doing it to the North
Koreans.
Maybe
the CIA needs better publicists.
Yeah, I mean, well, I don't think they wanted that publicized. I mean, I don't think they wanted I don't think they wanted that publicized. I mean, we have undertaken supply chain intervention operations against the North Koreans for many years. Some reporting is that it goes back to the George W. Bush administration, and certainly the Iranians as well. So, I mean, you can see that in the way that both of their ballistic missile and nuclear weapons programs have been delayed, but again, not completely diverted, right? Because the North Koreans do have that program. So this is all in that context, right? The North Koreans are making an aggressive push for better nuclear capabilities. They are undertaking aggressive test launches. Trump gets into office, and there's a question of how are we going to handle Kim? And I don't know if you want to go through all that stuff, but there's a...
I mean, look, and now we're getting to your piece, which is really, you know, if Trump wins, which Trump will it be when it comes to North Korea?
Yeah.
The Trump we all remember is the love letters with Kim that he took to Mar-a-Lago to show people, you know, the peacenik Trump trying to reach a deal with the North Koreans. But before that... He was talking about nuclear war.
Yeah. So I think I want to pause on this for a little bit because I think it's really important for the listener, right?
Sure.
We have all lived in such a memory hole over the last 4 to 8 years that 2017 seems again like many, many decades ago. And we have all absorbed so much information in between 2017 and now that it is when I went back to actually research this piece because I was hearing stuff from sources. And then I went back to look at the contemporaneous reported record and I was shocked. I mean, I was actually, and this, what I'm saying is this happened to me. I was shocked at the reporting in 2017 about the sense of the potential imminency of war between North Korea and the United States. And the stuff that was coming out contemporaneously, like I went back and looked at a transcript from, you know, Mike Pompeo speaking at the Aspen Security Forum in 2017. And that was the topic of discussion was, are we going to go to war with North Korea? Right. Like the D.C. foreign policy community was a flutter about this, both because of the launching of all of these missile launches, but also because of the rhetoric. I mean, literally, like the fire and fury rhetoric was about nuclear war with North Korea,
right.
And Kim was lobbying rhetoric, you know, rhetorical bombs back too, like about how they had nuclear capabilities and they could strike the American mainland. And by the time some of the folks in the administration got out and wrote their memoirs, like Mattis, just as a correction. Mattis's comments were to Woodward in his book Rage in 2020.
Right.
It wasn't that Mattis wrote it himself. So I just want to make sure about attribution there.
But McMaster writes in his book about this.
McMaster literally writes about being in a meeting, you know, where Trump says, well, why don't we just, you know, basically nuke the entire North Korean army during one of their big expansive parades that they like so much, you know? And he also, I believe, notes that Trump said, "Well, can we just blame it on somebody else? Like, can we bomb North Korea and basically make it look like somebody else did it?" You know,
Who would be the other? Who would be the somebody else candidate?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, there's South Korea, but that's going to be the causes belli. That's going to lead to nuclear war on the peninsula anyway, right? So there's really no world in which that isn't catastrophic, right? I mean, you know, Secretary of Defense Mattis apparently, you know, Woodward reports that Mattis is terrified that Trump is basically going to send him down this inexorable path where they're going to have to kill millions of people in North Korea, right? So this was not all just rhetoric, right? And I just want to be clear about this because some of this has been reported before, right? Woodward and others before him, I think Woodward in the most detail, reports that, like, you know, the military is always developing war plans and updating war plans, but they updated specific war plans during this time with the idea that, like, we might actually need to go to war with North Korea. And they developed specific plans to take out all the North Korean leadership and for a potential like invasion scenarios.
And as you point out in your piece, it wasn't just the Pentagon that was doing this. The CIA under Pompeo was drawing up some pretty fanciful plans themselves for paramilitary actions in North Korea to topple the regime.
Yes. So this is kind of the heart of the story that I wrote, which is, you know, the CIA has a paramilitary branch. It's known as the Special Activities Center. And a lot of those folks are from the special operations world, like JSOC, and they have close connections with the Pentagon. And Pompeo, who was, you know, was and is very hawkish on North Korea, initiated a kind of wholesale review To basically update these war plans. And this was undertaken by senior officials within the CIA's, again, Special Activity Center. So that's where all the paramilitaries are based. And there were a couple things that they did. One thing that they did was they went to their colleagues in the Pentagon in the Special Operations Command Korea, known as SOCCOR. And those are the folks that, you know, would be the kind of the tip of the spear for the Pentagon, if there was an invasion scenario. And, you know, I had these conversations where folks said to me, you know, we went and spoke to, you know, these guys on the Pentagon side because we were going to have to work with them. Like the CIA paramilitaries were going to be working with the special operations folks in the Pentagon very closely in case things went really pear-shaped. And they were flabbergasted. I mean, apparently, you know, what my CIA sources told me were they said, we could not believe how fanciful and rudimentary these things were. They hadn't been updated in decades. They were ludicrous. They were like, you know, the Pentagon was like, we'll just have CIA guys riding with us on tanks, and then they'll go up into the hills and recruit like hill people because hill people don't like city dwellers. Like they're literally, we're talking like a Vietnam era war playbook.
Actually, you know what that reminds me of? Remember in the 50s, early 50s, the CIA had plans for like overthrowing the communists in Albania and dropped in all sorts of, you know, trained people who were going to do exactly that.
Of course,
they all got wiped up.
Yeah, they all died.
Of course, there was a Soviet mole in British intelligence who's mainly responsible for that.
So there was two parts of this review. One was the review of the plans that would be executed in concert with the Pentagon, which people just lost. I mean, the people responsible for this review just thought were just crazy. And then there was, you know, their own kind of holiest of holy plans for, you know, if things went really, really bad. And even there, these plans apparently had sat on a shelf, you know, like gathering dust, and nobody had ever really. And this is kind of disturbing, to be honest, because, you know, in a way, it's very frightening that they were updating these plans with an eye toward the fact that this might actually be happening imminently because of what was going on with the Trump administration at the time. On the other hand, it's kind of scary that these plans were here for decades and nobody had looked at them, and everybody just thought, "Nah, they'll be fine. It'll be okay. These will be fine." The CIA's own plans also need a lot of updating. But even when they were trying to think of creative ways to, for instance, penetrate underground, you know, nuclear facilities in North Korea, they also didn't really have great answers to this, apparently. Like they started thinking about, I had one source say that they started asking about dog tech. And by dog tech, I literally mean putting things on dogs and sending them down into underground facilities. And some of these conversations that were happening, you know, one source said to me, they were like, well, you know, 80% of the people that are going to do this mission are going to die, but then a couple of you might live. So that might just be the case. So again, this was very, very disturbing on multiple levels for some of the CIA folks who were involved in overhauling these plans.
We'll now take a quick break. And we're back. The large question that you start out the piece is which Donald Trump will, if he becomes president again, which Donald Trump will we see on Korean policy? I want you to answer that. And also, let's look at Kamala Harris and what we could expect from a Harris administration, presumably very similar to what we've had under Biden, but take a whack at both.
Yeah. I don't know if I'm qualified on either, but I mean, I would say we don't know with Trump. I have a better answer for Trump than Harris. Let me put it this way. One important caveat is that even after, according to sources with whom I spoke, CIA folks, even after Trump made his love letters turn, you know, his like best buddies turn with Kim, the CIA was still running a very aggressive covert action campaign against the North Koreans to basically squeeze them financially because of all the sanctions that they were under. So there was an understanding that even while negotiations were ongoing, the CIA should not let up, and that that would actually provide the U.S. with a better negotiating position, which is not uncommon. This happened during Obama and Iran and the JCPOA era too, where like they were pushing and pushing and pushing. So, you know, it's important to disentangle Trump himself from some of the stuff that's going on under the hood, particularly with Trump. It's unclear, right? With Trump himself, during his RNC speech, he seemed quite conciliatory, again, with Kim. Mm-hmm. But who he brings in personnel-wise is going to have a big effect on that. And I would not be surprised if Kim starts saber-rattling again. Trump could quite easily turn on a dime again, and we could go back to the fire and fury days.
Is Pompeo a likely figure in a senior position in a second Trump administration?
I've heard his name bandied about for Secretary of Defense. I mean, right. He has not broken with Trump. He's one of the all. He's. I think he and Robert O'Brien are probably the two top national security officials serving under Trump who have not broken with him in any ways and have in fact endorsed him. So,
then you have the acolytes like Rick Grenell
and Cash Patel,
Cash Patel, who Cash Patel sees himself as CIA director, Grenell as Secretary of State.
Yes.
It's hard to imagine either one getting confirmed, but by the Senate, even with Republican control. But
I don't know. Mike Pompeo could certainly.
Pompeo could probably.
Yeah, I would imagine Pompeo would, and you and I both know from our extensive reporting on Assange that and Pompeo when he was CIA director that he is I read through part of his memoir which is even by DC standards an extraordinarily self-serving document, but all he talks about is quote unquote pipe hitters and how aggressive he was, and all he did was try to make the CIA more aggressive. And, him as Secretary of Defense, when Trump is leaning back into that fire and fury rhetoric and preparations, which Pompeo helped oversee, right? This is the point. It's like these folks, they have a blueprint and literal battle plans that were updated during the last time they were in office. And if something goes really bad on the peninsula, it's really unclear where we're going to go. I mean, I think things were quite a bit more dangerous than even with all the public talk about war in North Korea, things were a lot more dangerous than people understood contemporarily. Right. And that's also the kind of the bias, right? We like, even as much as we like to think something is going to turn out, like we discuss worst case scenarios without ever really believing they're going to come true. Right. Like there's just a basic psychological aspect to that. And North Korea is one of those cases where I think things were quite a bit worse than was even understood publicly at the time.
But look, even though North Korea hasn't been on the front pages all that much in recent years, going back to the two guys who we started this discussion out with, Carlin and Hecker, they say the situation is more dangerous now even than it was then, which does lead to the question, what's Biden been doing all these years on Korea, and what would we expect alternatively from a Harris administration?
That's a great question. I mean, I expect, an attempt to manage the problem, probably with more covert means than anything else, because, I had a CIA source once say to me, Democrats love covert action even more than Republicans because they try to manage.
Because it keeps it off the out of the news.
Right. You lower the temperature, you lower the temperature publicly, and you manage the issue covertly and in a way that most of the federal government, let alone the American people, just have no idea. I don't know this for a fact. I would suspect that these sabotage programs vis-a-vis their ballistic missile and nuclear programs are still very much ongoing. Those things tend to get, when a new administration comes in, they do reviews of pre-existing covert actions. But I would be very surprised if Biden somehow put an end to that. And I would also be very surprised if Harris, who, and this doesn't get talked about a lot, but Harris sat on CISI, for a few years. She,
tell us what Sissy is.
The Senate Intelligence Committee. She was actually, she was sitting on.
I had forgotten that, by the way.
Yeah. Well, she was,
I cover this stuff.
Yeah. She was, with Ron Wyden, to circle back to one of our previous stories, was one of the only folks who in 2016 or 2017 raised concerns about the labeling of WikiLeaks as a hostile foreign intelligence service while she was sitting on CISI. Which is like just an interesting data point now that she has a, a coin flip chance of becoming president. But so she has been briefed for a long time about North Korea and intelligence and covert action issues, going back to sitting on CISI and then with the PD, with the president's daily brief as vice president. So my suspicion is that she would probably try to keep things as quiet as possible. But, as they say, the enemy gets a vote, right? We don't know what, Kim has a tendency to raise temperature around transitions in order to extract as many concessions as possible. We don't know whether that is going to be a negotiating technique again, or he's actually just going to go for it.
Right. And then look, the Trump courtship of Kim, the friendliness to Kim, is part and parcel of a larger, phenomenon we've seen, which is his affinity for dictators, brutal dictators, from Vladimir Putin, most prominently, which has, resurfaced in recent weeks with the Bob Woodward book and the continued conversations with calls he's made to Putin since leaving the Oval Office. But it does raise, the same question you're asking about what his Korea policy would be the same question that a lot of people would have about his Russia policy, his Ukraine policy, his Mideast policy.
I think that, as you said,
which is to say, to give the devil his due, so to speak, is an instinct for conciliation, an instinct to try to work out a deal, the art of the deal. Right. Which a lot of liberals in another life would think was a good thing.
Well, yes, I think that. If I recall correctly from the transcript of his RNC speech, he literally, there's an aside where he said, it's nice to be nice to people with nuclear weapons, and basically basically the press keeps pillorying me for wanting to avoid war, especially nuclear war. And I am sympathetic to that perspective. I don't think anyone wants nuclear war. I think it's important to not, push boundaries with, unstable adversaries to the point where there might actually be a nuclear exchange. There was some recent reporting where apparently at some point in the beginning of the post-2022 full-scale invasion of Ukraine, the Biden administration assessed that Putin was at a 50-50 of thinking about dropping tactical nuclear weapons, which, by the way, say tactical. It's like that's enough to level, Nagasaki or Hiroshima, right? It's like we're talking about lower yield nuclear weapons that would still be catastrophic at a level that we haven't seen in many, many, many decades. So anyway, as an aside, the difficulty with me reconciling this with Trump in particular is that the rhetoric in 2017, when he was president, the first year of his office or so, was so extraordinarily overheated, that it's like it's hard for me to take his about face seriously or at face value, it's like if he was consistent in the way that he applied, his theory of foreign policy and international relations vis-a-vis nuclear armed adversaries, like that's one thing. But particularly in the case of North Korea, like we have never in my just at the top of my head, I guess there's the madman theory, right? People say that, well, maybe it's the madman theory coming to life, but I have no historical analog in modern American history of somebody publicly threatening a nuclear armed power with nuclear obliteration over and over and over and over again to basically, switch.
Flip.
Yeah, flip like that. And maybe it's a negotiating technique, but I don't know. You know?
It's the two sides of Donald Trump. Yes. And, you know, as somebody who has dealt with Donald Trump in the past, I've experienced both yelling, screaming, shouting, threatening to sue me, threatening to, you know, do God knows what, to being, you know, the next day, literally the next day, friendly, hey, come on up to the office. I'd like to pick your brain, you know, that kind of thing. So that's
the personality, right? Yeah. But when you apply that, I mean, look, it's one thing to do that when you are
with a journalist
or when you're trying to, you know, to get a contract through for a skyscraper in New York and you're dealing with city officials and subcontractors and like, that's one thing. But when you're talking about, you know, about North Korea, the stakes are quite a bit higher.
Yeah. Good time for us to take a break. And when we come back, I want to talk about the aforementioned Assange story, Mike Pompeo, and a guy who has picked up on it recently out of the blue. Last guy I would have expected, Tucker Carlson. All right. We are back with Zach Dorfman. As I mentioned at the top, Zach and I collaborated with another reporter, Sean Naylor, when we were at Yahoo some years ago, on a story that got quite a bit of attention at the time, which is the CIA's plans under Mike Pompeo, when he was CIA director, to kidnap Julian Assange from the Ecuadorian embassy where he was holed up. I should point out that we said in the piece that there was even talk going beyond that, loose talk, but talk nonetheless about possibly assassinating Assange. That was picked up by WikiLeaks and Assange's lawyers. They argued it to the British courts. They really didn't get very far with that. But as we all know, more recently, Assange has been released. There was a plea deal that basically freed him from the jail he was in Britain. He's now a free man. And there has been renewed talk about what we wrote some 3 years ago or so about what the CIA was up to. And as I mentioned before we took the break, Tucker Carlson keeps talking about this. He brings it up in multiple interviews as a way to go after Mike Pompeo. But what do you make of the recent renewed interest in what we reported some years ago?
Well, I think I've got a lot of different thoughts about the kind of long tail of this story. But one, I think it's important to, for listeners who might not have been following this story really, really closely, to understand is that, like, Assange was, for many, many years, going back to the Obama administration, there was a big debate within the U.S. government about whether to try and criminally charge Assange. And the Obama administration found itself deciding in the negative because of concerns about what they called the New York Times problem. And the New York Times problem was that the crimes in which they would charge Assange for, which is the Espionage Act in theory, could be applied to mainstream American publications and mainstream American journalists. Because if you work in the national security space, you're going to get into sensitive information, right? I mean, what, classified information. Mm-hmm. And so there was always this sense that, you know, we can't, that's a bridge too far. The Trump administration disagreed, and the Trump administration did something that at first caused a lot of reporters, I think, and First Amendment advocates much more broadly to feel some relief, which was that when they charged Assange, they charged him with something under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, I think, which is basically a hacking charge. This idea that Assange assisted Chelsea Manning to crack a password, which then allowed Manning to download a bunch of classified documents, which then WikiLeaks published, right? No mainstream journalist would ever assist a source in hacking something for materials. Now, if somebody receives documents that have been hacked, that's a different thing. But you do not work with a source to hack government documents or any documents for that matter. That's illegal. That's wrong. So reporters, First Amendment advocates, breathed a sigh of relief. But But then, after that, they appended on Espionage Act charges, which essentially said Assange was a publisher. He published material that was classified, U.S. government classified, and therefore we're going to charge him under this incredibly overbroad, terribly written World War I era statute that, in essence, if applied in certain ways, could criminalize journalism, or big parts of journalism. I just need listeners to understand this because it's important. This is an important windup to why it matters in a potential like forthcoming second Trump administration, because Trump administration officials said, we don't know that this is a one time deal. Assange is unique, but like we're not entirely nobody's entirely sure what how that's going to bear out. And so Carlson talking about Assange is very interesting because eventually this was a hot potato that I don't think the Biden people really wanted to deal with. Like the indictment was filed before Biden got into office, and then but they didn't drop the charges. Right. There were back and forth negotiations, and eventually Assange pleaded guilty to Espionage Act charges in order for the extradition attempts to be dropped because Assange was in UK prison fighting extradition to the US. Assange is now a free man. But these charges were filed during the Trump era. And it's interesting to me that folks like Carlson have gone to bat over and over and over again for Assange pretty publicly. While, you know, it was Trump's own administration that took this step that other prior administrations would not because it was considered right. too dangerous from a presidential standpoint.
Well, also, I mean, it starts with Pompeo saying WikiLeaks should be treated as a hostile foreign intelligence agency, right? Which opened the doors for the CIA to take much more aggressive actions than it otherwise might have. And, you know, there were some pretty extreme measures under consideration. Why don't you remind our listeners what they were talking about.
So there's two important things there. The labeling of WikiLeaks as the non-state hostile intelligence service basically put WikiLeaks in the same category as like Hezbollah, right? And whatever you think about WikiLeaks, I think it is reasonable.
They don't fire missiles.
It's not an intelligence service. Like WikiLeaks, what it is and what it isn't, it's a complex question, but it is not a foreign intelligence service, and putting it within the same legal category, which gave the CIA certain capabilities in terms of how they treated WikiLeaks, I think was an overreach. And many folks thought it was an overreach, including within CIA, you know? And so what they started doing was they started intensive surveillance on WikiLeaks members. They started hacking into, you know, WikiLeaks, or at least attempting to hack into WikiLeaks databases. And they started discussing very seriously, being pushed by Pompeo, you know, kidnapping Julian Assange, who at the time this all started had sought refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. He'd been there for years. And so there were plans to basically break into the Ecuadorian embassy, right? So you're staging an operation on British soil, and then you're breaking into sovereign Ecuadorian soil to kidnap Assange and throw him into a plane and basically render him, you know, war on terror style, back to the United States to have him face charges. There were even discussions about killing Assange. I mean, there were actual discussions like, well, The kidnapping plots were actually much more well developed. The assassination plots were much looser, or the assassination discussion. Right. But the fact that this was being discussed at all, you know,
right,
for somebody who can, you know, who has reasonable claim to being a journalist. Again, I don't want to get into the minutiae of, you know, of who Assange is and isn't. But like the fact is that this would be, you know, this was, you know, an extraordinary escalation in hostilities toward a guy who, you know, is, if not a journalist, was at least journalism adjacent.
Right. Well, I just want to close out with, two observations. One, when we did the piece, we weren't carrying water for Julian Assange, at least from my perspective.
Not at all.
He was a guy who was the handmaiden to the Russians in their interference in the 2016 election, actually actively solicited the material from Guccifer 2.0, who was the Russian GRU intel agent who was, or at least the persona of, one who had hacked the DNC emails and the Podesta emails. And we can talk about extreme measures that may have gone too far. That's not necessarily a defense of Julian Assange and everything he's done.
Far for me to defend. I don't think, and it was interesting because, I think you probably got this after the piece, is that there were people who came out of the woodwork who just assumed that we were somehow like stalwart defenders. And that was not the case whatsoever. And, it was interesting because that story upset a lot of people from all sides. Because this was one of those cases where, if you're going to do this work honestly, you have to talk about, extraordinary legal, legal excesses vis-a-vis entities that you might find abhorrent, right? And like my or your opinion of Julian Assange has nothing to do with the scandalousness of the things that were under discussion in 2017 under Pompeo vis-a-vis Assange and WikiLeaks more broadly.
Exactly. And just, my final observation on the Tucker Carlson phenomenon that we've been talking about. My sense is, Carlson is very much of the sort of neo-isolationist America First brand of Trumpism. No end to forever wars. He sees Pompeo as the direct opposite, in the Trump camp. And he wants people like Pompeo exiled from a second Trump administration. And he's using our story as a way to help that. At least that's my gut.
That's a good theory.
Until Tucker Carlson calls me up and wants to talk about it and dispute my analysis, I'll stick with it. Zach Dorfman, there's so much else I would love to talk to you about, but we've been going on for a while now. So I'm going to call it quits right here with a pledge that we will have you back to talk about other of your amazing reporting in the intel area.
Anytime, Mike. Always a great pleasure.
Okay, thank you. And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.com news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Michael Isikoff. Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Hey, it's Jody Hamilton.
And Sean Smith-Pierce.
Here's a taste of what you might have missed from the Politics Bar.
Jody, I was listening to you this morning, filling in for Steph. You and Chris were debating, and just for the record, Jody is right. Chris's argument is that there is some truth to what's being said about the left being in their own information silo. Right.
Basically, we started talking about how Gavin Newsom has invited people on his podcast, high up MAGA guys.
Yeah. Well-known right-wing propagandists. That's what they are. Yeah.
And my argument is he shouldn't be inviting them because nobody on that side is listening to Gavin Newsom.
Right. It doesn't help to bring propagandists into a sphere where truth matters because they're just going to lie their asses off anyway.
Right.
So here is a public service message for Chris Lavoie. Jody Hamilton is right. Catch all that and more weeknights at the Politics Bar, available through your favorite progressive radio station, your favorite podcast player, or online anytime at thepoliticsbar.com.